Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. It can save you time and money so you provide your family with a financial safety net starting today. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius gives you unbiased advice from a licensed expert. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot from customers who have found the best fit for their needs. Policy Genius helps you compare your options from top companies and their teams of licensed experts. Talk to a team of award-winning agents who will walk you through the process step by step. Easily compare quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. Your work-life insurance policy might not be enough to protect your family's needs. Finding the right policy can be time-consuming and overwhelming. Let Policy Genius help you find the right policy and protect your family today.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 15.
Altitude.
Tower to my expenses, release to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
Loves me, I'm ready to play. My parent
ramp curveballs at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
Next, picture 16,000.
Viper 1 targeted.
This episode is sponsored by Hangar 24 Craft Brewing. Their main tap room is located on Redlands, California, where they brew all their beer in-house. They have additional tap rooms in Orange County, as well as Lake Havasu. I fell in love with Hangar 24 when I flew the Hangar 24 Airfest back in 2018. It's a great company that makes amazing beer. I'm excited to be a part of the Hangar 24 family. Encourage you to go over and check out hangar24brewing.com. And if you're in the SoCal area or Lake Havasu, swing by one of their tap rooms. I'd also like to thank Squadron Posters. Again, a company that I just absolutely love, and I've been a customer of theirs for several years. They have upped the game from just making posters to share the adventure and your journey through life. I would encourage you to swing by squadronposters.com and check out their bomber style artwork. It's a really cool way to display, again, your journey. And also, they have metal nose art. So if you want something that looked like it just came off the side of a plane with whatever graphic design you want on there, they can do that. Swing over to squadronposters.com and orders over $59 or more receive a 10% discount with the discount code RAIN10. That's RAIN10. I'd also like to thank Wingman Watches for sponsoring this podcast. Again, another company that I just absolutely love, and I love their products. If you're looking to build a custom watch, this is their bread and butter. You can work with their design team to commemorate your journey, your organization, your unit, whatever it might be, through a custom watch that's affordable and is high quality. Swing by wingmanwatch.com, and you can use the code RAIN10 to receive a discount on any current watch that's on there, or you can mention my name to receive a discount on your group customization order. Mention my name to receive a discount on your group order, or if you see a watch you already love on the site, you can use the code RAIN10 to receive 10% off your watch purchase. And if you just say something, we really will know we're good. Okay, you failed the say something part.
Oh, something.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
Here we go. This might be the best opening yet. I think every time it gets better and better. Flynn, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Everyone, I have my good buddy, Mason Locke. You'll hear me call him Flint. He's an F-16 instructor pilot out at Holloman Air Force Base. We were assigned together at Shaw, flying the mighty Block 50 Viper. And now you're flying something with a slightly smaller engine.
But still
just as cool.
So It's close.
Flint, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Before we get really rolling into it, will you kind of tell everyone the elevator pitch of Flint Locke, kind of who you are, what you're doing now, and how you got there?
Ooh, elevator pitch. That's how many floors are we going up?
We're only going up three floors, so we're already past the first floor.
All right, yeah. So I grew up in a small farming town about an hour southwest of Houston called East Bernard, Texas. My dad was a crop duster or aerial applicator, ag pilot, whatever the proper term is. And so that's really what got me into aviation. I went to Texas A&M University, did the Corps of Cadets there, was in Squadron 3, and then commissioned into the Air Force. Went through Euro-NATO joint jet pilot training there at Shepherd. Got the F-16, went through the Texas Air National Guard, then went to Korea for a little while, to Shaw, where we got to hang out for a few years, and now I'm instructing in the F-16 at Holloman Air Force Base, New Mexico.
Yeah, you spent a lot of time in Texas. I didn't know you went through, I guess I probably did know it, but I've since forgotten. I apologize.
No worries.
That you went through guard training in the Viper. So
it was a slightly non-standard career path, and I've gotten to see the world since, but I did find it ironic when I grew up in Texas, went to college in Texas, went to pilot training in Texas, went to F-16 training in Texas, and I tried pretty hard to get a spot at Fort Worth to just stay in Texas, which in hindsight, I'm glad I kind of got out of the state and branched out. But yeah, I spent about the first 23, 24 years of my life in Texas.
Yeah, you really branched out all the way over there to New Mexico now.
That's right. I could be in Texas in literally 45 minutes.
But I know, short stint in South Carolina as well as South Korea, and then a few other garden spots in the world. But yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing now, what your role is?
Yeah, so I instruct at the B course at Holloman Air Force Base. So the B course is what we call in the Air Force, I think the Navy calls it the RAG.
Sounds about right.
Similar idea there. It's where we take pilots that have just come out of pilot training and are training them specifically in the aircraft that they're going to fly, which for us is the F-16. So there are several bases around now that produce F-16 pilots. You got Luke in Phoenix, Tucson Air National Guard has a few squadrons there. And then there's Kelly Field in Texas, where I went through. Holloman is actually recently stood up. When we went through it, it wasn't here yet, but they've since moved some F-16s here, moved another squadron here, and now there's three F-16 squadrons all doing training. So it's actually the biggest F-16 training base in the Air Force right now, training new pilots and bringing pilots back that have been on staff, been at the Pentagon, as well as folks that are maybe transitioning from a different airframe to the F-16, like guys going to the Thunderbirds usually come through Holloman to get their F-16 qualifications.
You know, I'm really sad that I didn't get to spend more time in Holloman. I think most people say that, but it actually is not a bad little spot. You got the mountains up to the north, but the fact that we moved from Phoenix, where the predominantly all F-16 training occurred, to Holloman, I think was a big sore spot for a lot of F-16 pilots, but it's what you made it, right?
So there's definitely, I think, when you mention Holloman and Alamogordo, New Mexico, there's an initial kind of reaction from everyone. But I'll say, I would say probably 9 out of 10 people that come out here and spend a little time out here really end up changing their mind, because if you like the outdoors, there's so much to do. And for me, being from the flatlands of Texas, like the flattest land that you can think of, in the most humid land you can think of, right on the coast next to Houston. It's just hot, muggy. Moving out here into the desert, which is pretty awesome dry heat. It's much better than the humidity. Was a nice move, but then there's the mountains right next door. So I'm in a desert right now. The base is in the desert basin, but you can drive up the mountain in 20 minutes and it feels like you're in Colorado. I mean, it's cool. There's trees. There's wintertime. There's all kinds of skiing, snowboarding, if you like to hike, fish. There's a lot of ATVing out here. So I think most people really find that Holloman's not too bad. If you love the big city, though, you're going to be that one guy that wants to get out of here as soon as you can. But I really like it.
Yeah, I enjoyed my time, especially when I was out there visiting with you. You did show me that there's mountains and other things to do. So I do appreciate that. You turned my opinion on Holloman just ever so slightly.
And I mean, the biggest draw is we're in New Mexico, but we have the best Texas barbecue that most people have ever had.
Yeah.
I would put up against anyone in Texas, to include the famous joints.
Yeah. It was phenomenal barbecue. Mad Jack's
Mountaintop Barbecue. Man.
It's good. Let's talk a little bit about the B Corps specifically. How many B Coursers are you putting through each year there?
Each year. So each squadron will have usually between a 15 to 16 pilot class twice a year is what it is now. That's we've ramped up production probably from when we went through. I think it was about the same class size, but it was every 9 months. And now the classes have been kind of compressed to try and produce more F-16 pilots. So it's two per year. And then we just have onesie twosies folks moving over from a different airframe, maybe a general that's getting requalified that kind of come through and leave during those classes, you know.
So here's my question for you. Like, obviously the Air Force went through a fighter pilot shortage a few years ago. I think COVID has solved some of that with people not getting out, a multitude of efforts or lines of effort to try and gap that with increasing pilot training production, fighter pilot production, retention programs. But do you see just putting more bodies in jets right now at the cost of quality, or do you think quality is being maintained? Has the Air Force figured that out? What's Flint Locke's opinion on this?
All right, so that's obviously a tough question. We are definitely trying to push more people through faster than we did in the past to help offset that shortage that you mentioned. But for certain, we are not lowering our quality. We like to say MIF is MIF, which I'll be honest, I forget what MIF even stands for, but it's basically the standard that a task must be operated and demonstrated at for them to pass. And for us instructors here, you know, we understand there's a shortage, but it's about safety for the air crew. So the pilots and their wingmen, and then the people on the ground that, as you've seen interviewing folks in our deployment and such, that you're supporting on the ground. So making sure that the pilots are trained to a level where they can safely and effectively, you know, produce air power for our nation, that has not suffered. Because if they, you know, don't do well in a ride because they got their hours cut, well, guess what? I'm going to hook them and they're going to see it again. And so there's definitely more, and it, you know, we're burning the midnight oil and trying to push more classes through, but we are not cutting the quality that we expect ride to ride.
You guys are still washing people out of the B course. That still occurs, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a tough job being a single seat fighter pilot, and not everyone is cut out for it. You know, that doesn't mean you're a bad pilot or a bad officer by any stretch, but it's a very demanding, high stress job at times. And so some people, for whatever reason, just don't make it through. The Air Force is usually great about assigning them a different airframe, and, you know, they go on to serve, but just not in the F-16.
So last question about the B course, and then we'll talk about Flint Locke and your career up until this point and what that has entailed. But the B course, what does it look like for your average B course who walks in day one? What are they capable of doing when they start and when they finish? What does it take to get them to being a combat mission ready wingman?
Yeah, so absolutely. They show up as winged aviators from Air Force pilot training, generally speaking. So most of them have flown the T-6, transitioned to the T-38, although we are now seeing some folks from pilot training next, which is a whole discussion on its own, that have actually never flown the T-38. But for the most part, that's going to be your standard path to getting your wings. So they show up with that, but they got a long way to go because the F-16 is a pretty big step up from either of those planes. So they start off with a front load of academics, you know, learning the systems, maybe bringing in some of the weapons as they begin, and then they hit simulators. So doing a lot of emergency procedures and then getting interface with the avionics and that sort of thing. Then after a pretty big block of simulators, they hit the flight line, and we start with what's called TR, transition, where they're just learning to take off and land and get from point A to point B in the F-16, that they're going to finish that phase, which is five flights. Usually they solo on their third or fourth ride, and then a check ride, which is their first official Air Force check ride, where they get an actual form aid, and it goes in their permanent record. After that, we start using the F-16 as it was designed to be, so as a weapon, and they do air to air first. So starting off small, and it's a building block approach. So one versus one dogfighting, offensive, defensive, and neutral. Then move up to 2v1, which my dad loved to say like 2v1. So it's you versus two bad guys. And I'm like, no, it's actually two good guys versus a single bad guy. And he's like, well, that's not fair. And I was like, you would be surprised how hard it is
toughest
to fight as a team to kill one adversary. So we do that. And then we just continue moving on 2v2, 4v4. We go from within visual range out to beyond visual range. So again, building block concept. After that, they transition to air to ground, usually with about two months left. Start with the basics of dropping bombs. So unguided, you know, kind of old school dive bombing, strafing runs. They get to shoot the mighty M61 Vulcan cannon there, which is always fun.
America.
And then they end the course moving up all the way to precision guided munitions. So laser guided bombs, JDAMs, which we get to actually have them drop. And sometimes if we're lucky, the instructors get them too.
Nice.
And then their capstone is putting that all together. So fighting your way in air to air, dropping bombs, and then fighting your way out. And oh, by the way, as they're doing that, we also learn to do all of that at night. And so by the time they leave, they've learned hundreds of pages of interface for how to cue the different weapons with all the various switches on the throttle and stick so that they can go to their combat unit. They do a quick spin up and they get stamped as combat mission ready by the Air Force.
That's cool. So I said that was going to be the last question, but then you said pilot training next. And that is something that has fascinated me because that's one of those efforts the Air Force is doing to increase pilot production. How do we streamline? How do we make pilot training more efficient? So you guys actually have people showing up who have never flown the T-38.
Not many. It's still an anomaly, but yes.
How's that going?
It's different. Because I mean the standard like that you like to say is, oh, this is just like you saw in the T-38 and IFF, or the F-16 has the same inertial navigation system as the T-38. Like you hear that a lot in the academics, like it's just like the T-38 for some of the more basic stuff. And then you've got one person raising their hand saying, I never flew the T-38. Like, oh, that does change the ball game. I think there's a lot of potential in how we can leverage some of the technologies that we're doing with PTN, and we're kind of working out the kinks of how to best use them to really synergize the pilot product that we're getting now. Motor Riley deployed with us. Good buddy.
Yep.
He's in charge of it. You ought to have him on the show.
Yeah, I need to. I heard he was doing that, and that's a good point. I had heard a lot about pilot training next right before I separated active duty, and I know there are some people, myself included, who are skeptics. I never went there, but Flash Edwards is one of those guys, B course instructor at Luke. He went out and tour pilot training next. And when he came back, he was sold based on the technology they're using and how it could be leveraged to make improvements to the different syllabi and things like that for all training together. It is interesting though, to see, I mean, I remember my first T-38 ride from the T-6, like took off, went out to the airspace. And I think I was still sitting on the runway, you know, like,
absolutely.
Mentally. Yeah. And it's a big switch going from a just turboprop to an afterburning jet engine, let alone that to an F-16, you know?
Yeah, about double or triple it, I'd say.
No big deal. Huh. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens and how the Air Force transforms. It's one of those things we always say, like, well, that's how we always have done it, you know? And pilot training has been around since the 50s. We've always done it that way. So leveraging technology and making improvements, I think, is a good thing.
And absolutely. With like the new T-7 coming online, I don't know if taking a fast jet out of the loop to speed things up is the right answer, because we're going to be spending a lot of money on that. And it looks like a really cool aircraft and trainer.
Yep.
But I think it'll be interesting to see as we learn more about how pilots can use things like VR and AI to learn putting it all together and hopefully just improving what is already, I would argue, the best quality of pilot training in the world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, now we kind of know what you're doing. And now, I'd like to peel back the onion on who Flint Locke is and how you got to this point.
So, oh boy, let's peel it.
Yeah, what got you hooked in aviation? What made it all click and start for you?
Oh, that's pretty easy. It was growing up out in the country with my dad as a crop duster. So I grew up pretty much on a farm, ranch type environment and flying or having a big yellow planes flying around all the time. So from a young age, I was just into airplanes. And what I grew up with of flying low is not probably what most people into aviation think of when they think about airplanes flying low. So something that my dad used to do, he's retired now, but they'd be flying around and we'd be out working on the ranch, maybe driving a tractor. And he was a master of sneaking up on you. You know, he would, I don't know, peek over the trees and he'd look at a field and be like, oh yeah, Mason's out there today shredding weeds. And he would time it to where you are facing away and he would just sneak in and zoom, fly right over the top of you. Most crop dusters have a smoke, kind of like a air show plane that they use to determine what direction the wind's blowing for which way the chemicals are going to go. And so you just get this oily smoke. And especially on a John Deere 4440 that I was usually driving, the sound of that turboprop approaching when you didn't see it sounds like the turbocharger on that thing running away. And so your heart would start to beat and you'd look at the RPMs and oh no, the engine's about to blow. And then all of a sudden, zoom, his plane would fly right over, seemingly, you know, just about to hit you. And I swear that has carried over into my current life as a fighter pilot. Because after, you know, that happens a few times when you're 5 years old, you start scanning the horizon anytime you're out.
Yep.
And so I grew up kind of, we teach students how to do this visual scan pattern to look for enemy aircraft, you know, line of sight, that sort of thing. So my entire childhood was spent looking on my shoulder, waiting for big airplanes to swoop down and scare the living tar out of me. And I think that's helped in my current career because I'm like, oh yeah, I can see that guy on the horizon, just like watching out for dad. I mean, we'd be driving, you know, into town and he'd recognize your car because they fly slowly. He's like, oh, there they are. And then zoom right that's over awesome. The road. Just terrifying.
That's so awesome. What made the transition then from, you know, why aren't you a crop duster? What made you go into the Air Force?
Man, why aren't I a crop duster? That is a good question. That looks so much fun.
Well, you're still young, so you still could do that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Man, that's a good question. So I don't really remember when, but I was like, I want to fly for the military. I think it'd be cool to serve my country. I like flying low. I think it'd be cool to fly fast. And so, obviously, there's the Air Force and the Navy, and I'm not much of a waterman. So I was like, I want to go to the Air Force. I think that's pretty cool. Didn't really have my heart set on any airframe. But then when I was, I believe, a freshman in high school, I got to go tour the F-16s out at Ellington Field in Texas there when they were still based there at Houston. And I was sold on the F-16. And from that point on, I was like, I want to fly the F-16. I think it's the coolest plane. Still do.
America.
There's some other cool planes out there, but I love the F-16. And so that's, I don't know. It's from a pretty young age. And I told myself I could probably still do crop dusting, like you said, because I'd still like to try that. It looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it does. I feel like you can get away with a lot there, but it's just fun flying low.
Yeah, you can't get away with it. I mean, you are bound under Part 137 of the FARs. Yeah. They just have the blanket, person or property, can't get close unless part of the actual dispensing mission. So,
yeah, it would be a lot of fun. Having talked to a few crop dusters, it obviously is very dangerous. It's not just go zip around. Like, you're very focused. There's not a whole lot of time to react when you have something go wrong and you're a foot off the ground.
Absolutely. So that is, for one thing, that's very true about how it is not just you go out and zoom around. There's actually a lot that goes into modern crop dusting, you know, which is kind of probably still a public misconception based on, I don't know, the scenes from North by Northwest or whatever, but they're pretty,
throwback.
They're pretty sophisticated with, they use GPS almost in a kind of like a HUD. It's called a light bar for really precision application. Always looking out, obviously, for towers and guy wires are the big dangers. So making sure that they're well aware of where they're going and where they can actually fly low. Yeah, it's a pretty actually advanced industry for all that.
So when I did my ATP, one of the guys getting his ATP along with me was a crop duster. And he was telling a story of when he hit a power line. He's like, there are those who have and those that will. And yep. So his story, you know, it was kind of a hazy day, whatever it might be, but ends up clipping this power line. No big deal because it cut the line, landed safely, but he cut the power line and it went to some factory that shut the factory down for like 4 hours. So his insurance, it covers it, but he ended up having to pay, or his insurance had to pay several hundred thousands of dollars in like lost productivity. And like, you know, it was some rare, I don't know, item or whatever was on the line that day that just ended up costing a ton of money. So
that's true. I'm trying to think of any crop duster I know that hasn't hit a power line, and I'm drawing a blank. I'm drawing a blank, man.
So when you think about it, maybe if you're always saying I hit power lines, I don't know if I want to do this business. But no, that's cool. And it's awesome to see, you know, having that hook of aviation such a young age. Similar, you know, for me, but again, what you've gone and done is not just a, hey, I'm gonna go out there and do it. It's a long-term goal that you have to go out there and pursue. Takes a lot of effort, a lot of energy, and it's just a long road to get there.
And I mean, it's easy for me to say because obviously my dad was my aviation inspiration, but I really do think maybe other than some of the elite airshow performers, when you talk straight stick and rudder skills, crop dusters and maybe some of those fire bombers out there have the best stick and rudder skills of any pilots today.
Seeing those guys like in a DC-10 just skirting the mountains and dropping hundreds of thousands of gallons of water. Like, I mean, the CG, everything's changing. Like it's pretty impressive to see. So now kind of fast forward into your Air Force career, you go obviously the standard route of going through pilot training, earning your F-16, no small feat in itself. What was the highlight or what is the highlight of your F-16 career thus far?
I'd say, just to put you on the spot. Yeah, no, I think that's pretty easy answer is our deployment out to the Middle East. We're actually, you know, supporting troops on the ground, doing live missions with dropping actual bombs on the bad guys. I will say that being an instructor at Holloman is awesome. It's incredibly rewarding. I've really come to enjoy it. And I'm going to keep doing it for a while, staying here. But there's really nothing like hearing that there are troops in contact, that there's a danger close drop. Of course, for our deployment, it was ISIS, and we're mostly supporting our Iraqi allies. And then to an extent in the northern parts and in Syria, the Kurds, that they were under fire from ISIS, which I think, you know, worldwide, unequivocally, they're the bad guys. Getting to, you know, be the air power that saved those guys' life and help us push back the tide of ISIS. That has been the highlight of my career.
Yeah, it's it. Same for me too. And I've had Chaos on the podcast earlier in the season where we talked about pyro on the deployment. But I think, you know, that I would say that deployment hands down was by far like the most rewarding experience for me as well. And purely just like join the Air Force because I really wanted to get back to the guys that did 9/11. Obviously the world evolved and there's new bad guys. So being able to go out there and do the mission is super rewarding. I think for me, the highlight sortie I had was actually my second to last combat sortie, but it was with you.
Yeah.
And it was one that I just remember it was a bland, boring day.
It was the day that there was a dust storm.
Yeah. Couldn't see anything. We're up in Kobani, right?
Hadn't seen anything like it. Yep. We were way up there in northern Syria. Yep.
So I remember coming off the tanker, I think maybe after our first or second tanking. Mm-hmm. And then do you remember what happened after that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'd come off the tanker and we were checking back in with C2 to tell them, hey, we're done tanking and we're going to go back to our mission area in northern Syria. And they sounded bored. They're like, okay, you're cleared.
Yeah, there's no one flying.
We're tanking now anyway, so we don't have our radar up. We can't see you. Like, good luck. I was like, yeah, it's fine. We'll be fine. And then on that C2 frequency came a panicked voice asking for our assistance. And they called us by our call sign. I forget what it was, but I think it was like
Weasel 3-1,
maybe.
Yeah, I think it was Weasel 3-1. Yeah.
It's like Weasel 3-1, request your immediate assistance. My engine just blew up on the tanker and I'm might have to punch out. And so, man, hearing that on that frequency, it's like, whoa, that'll get your heart racing real quick. Because as weird as it sounds, you know, your first combat drop, your heart's racing pretty hard. But after doing it for 6 months, you know, you still take it seriously and it's still a big deal, but it becomes more routine. It's your job, you know? So when they say cleared hot, your heart's not racing every time you hit the pickle button. You just get used to it. But we were about to leave and that radio call, just hearing his voice, that got my heart racing. Hearing that he was in distress and not over friendly territory and in a dust storm.
Yeah, I remember that was the same for me. I think because at that point, you know, like dropping bombs is like just putting your pants on in the morning. Obviously, it was something you had to do and you had to do right. But hearing an American who's potentially going to eject, like I remember my heart was just like pumping. I think we turned to the south and then racing because they were coming out of Syria going into, is it Al-Assad?
Yeah, the Marines had just taken over Al-Assad.
Gosh.
We got in communication with him, started heading towards his position, and basically he communicated his engine had blown up while he was on the tanker. And so now he was single engine, but the explosion had actually damaged the aircraft, and the A-10's a rugged aircraft, and it is built to fly off one motor, as most twin engine aircraft are. But that damage had made it to where he, below a certain speed, the aircraft became uncontrollable. And so he actually had to keep a dive on the aircraft to keep it from going out of control. So he, in essence, could not fly on one engine. He was a powered glider. Fortunately, you know, he was close enough to Al-Assad. He was heading that way, but his wingman was also out of gas because that happened before he got fuel as well. So, we were basically the closest friendly aircraft that could do anything if the worst was going to happen and he had to eject over that enemy territory in that dust storm.
That's one of those, because he too, you know, also to build a picture in that time frame, like if you got captured by ISIS, it just wasn't going to end well. You know, the Jordanian pilot that we flew with and, you know, he was captured and murdered. So I think, you know, for me, that was all weighing in that moment.
Absolutely.
Of like having to get there and
absolutely
be able to, you know, protect and defend and get him picked up as quick as possible if he had to eject.
Yeah, I remember thinking like we hadn't dropped any bombs at that point. So I was like, okay, we have 8 bombs. We've got about 1,000 rounds of 20 mic. I will launch all my air-to-air missiles at the ground, just in the general direction of anyone I see going towards him once he's on the ground. And then I'm going to jettison my fuel tanks and I'll try and hit him if I have to. But I was like, we will do everything we can if this guy has to eject down to keep anyone from getting to him until we can get the rescue forces here.
And so at that time too, rescue forces, I think they actually had positioned some at Al-Assad at that point, but previously it was a 4-hour turn to reach pretty much anyone like on the western part of Iraq, I think. So not a good spot to be if you have to punch out and bad guy land and not have any friendly forces come for quite a while. I think that by far, that was my most memorable combat sortie.
And it was
my second to last one. And we wrap up that deployment. You actually ran into him a couple times, didn't you? That A-10
pilot. So, man, when I was the F-16 liaison officer at the KAOC in Al Udeid, Qatar, for a couple weeks. he and another A-10 pilot actually diverted from their base where they were stationed due to weather. And so they came in, and the A-10 liaison officer, he's like, "Hey, we got two guys diverting. You want to go out to the flight line and say hi?" So, you know me, I love airplanes. F-16 is my favorite, but I love all airplanes, big, small, fast, slow. So I was like, "Yeah, I want to go look at an A-10. That thing's got a big gun." And so we go out there, and, you know, the pilots come in, and I'm like, "Hey, can we look around?" And absolutely. So I met him there, and it's like, wow, that's a pretty small world. Cause we get back from that sortie, you know, we watch him, we sprint down there as fast as we can in afterburner, get him on the radar, get him in our targeting pods. We get calm with the JTAC and we watch him land safely. So it's a happy ending to that story, obviously, him landing at a friendly field. And so, but then once we land a few hours later, I call down to the A-10 squadron. I'm like, "Hey, I just want to check, like, everything okay with the A-10 guy?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, that was so-and-so. He's okay. It's all good. Everyone's safe." And I was like, "No way. That is, that's the same guy that was at the KAOC with me." Yeah. And so it was a small world there. And then on the redeployment, we stop in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean at Lodge's Field. So again, it's a big world out there, Rain. It's a real big world. You know, I know there's not that many airports, but there's a lot of them. And that same day that we stopped through, the A-10s came in there too. And so we walk into the base ops while we're packing up the jets, and lo and behold, the same guy's there. So I got to shake his hand after that incident and got to reminisce on it a little bit. And it was great. Great feeling for me. And I know it was the same for you, just to know we didn't need to do anything, you know, spectacular. But we were there in case he needed us, and he was thankful, and I was glad we were there too.
Yeah, I'm glad it worked out the way. I remember on the way down there, because we're like stores limit, just hauling the mail, trying to reach him.
0.95.
Yeah, you sent me over to the JTAC for that ROZ, mm-hmm. So restricted operating zone, and there was some French like Mirage on the frequency who was just like vomiting all over the frequency and would not shut up. He was talking about some, you know, NAI scan he was doing at some road that had nothing going on. I was like, "You have just no idea. Just please stop talking. Please stop talking." But that by far definitely got the heart rate up, I think, higher than anything else. And it's like you hear Americans or, you know, friendlies in trouble, period. Like that's gonna get the blood going for sure.
But man, it really hits home, you know, knowing it's another aviator kind of in that situation he was in. You know, it's just a little bit different because it's like, "Hey, that could be me. And I only have one engine."
Right. It wouldn't work out so well. Although I did it like the Dutch while we're there, they took a 7.62 round right down the intake thing. Just chewed it right up and just kept on going.
Chewed it up like a boss.
Yeah. Just going to keep on running. It was a Pratt & Whitney. I don't know if that would be the case. I just lost Pratt.
I think theirs are.
I thought they were GE.
Nope. I think the Dutch, they're Pratts.
You would know more than I would. That's for sure.
It's a good motor.
Still. It is.
I'll take the 129 though.
Yeah. Gosh. Oh man. That brings back some memories. That was definitely a memorable deployment. There's definitely some highs and definitely some lows that came with that one. But all in all, I think it was the highlight of my career as well. Well, before we wrap up here, Flint, I'll give you just a second to think, but you're gonna have a moment to pontificate and leave people with just some words of wisdom. And you have a very accomplished career. It took a lot of work, a lot of dedication. So for Flint, who is running around age 15, is there anything you would have said to yourself, to 15-year-old Flint?
Oh, man. Would I say anything to my 15-year-old self about getting on the path that I'm now on? There's some weird time paradoxes that could happen here. So I'm not sure I would want to say anything. It could cause the universe to implode. Not really, because I was at 15. You know, some people aren't sure really what path they want to take, but at 15, I knew that I wanted to fly for the United States Air Force. And I'd be happy to do it in whatever capacity they let me. But if they had an F-16 for me, that was what I wanted to do. And so even back then, just thinking about some of the decisions I made, it was all looking towards that eventual goal of being an Air Force fighter pilot. So I would just say, don't put it off till tomorrow or till next month or next year. If you're like, oh, I want to start, you know, getting my resume ready for when I apply for the Air Force someday, like try and make good grades now. Don't get into trouble, do anything stupid. Take care of yourself. Like I know this is going to offend anyone listening in Texas high school, but I quit football because I torn my ACL once in the eighth grade, and I played my next year, and it wasn't, I could feel it on my ACL every day. And I was like, I don't want to tear my ACL again. It might keep me from being a fighter pilot one day. So pretty much every decision I made, even at that age, was trying to get into an Air Force jet. So I would just say, be focused and work hard.
That's huge, especially quitting football in Texas.
Man, you're telling me. got some dirty looks.
That's awesome, though. I mean, definitely anything you want to do, it's just going to take a lot of work, and you're going to have to make sacrifices to get there. Prime example, not playing high school football in Texas.
I know.
Well, Flint, I appreciate you taking the time today. Awesome story. I look forward to seeing what you're going to do in the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years of your flying career, because you'll probably age out by then, I think. But
maybe I'll still be flying.
Till the end of my days.
Yep.
No.
Yep.
Thanks for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. Flint, I know people are going to enjoy your story.
You bet. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Again, wherever you're listening, hit subscribe. And if you can, leave me a rating and review over on iTunes. That definitely helps out. Until next time, don't bring a week.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.